The Grey Cup is not won in February. Like, I don't remember Hamilton or Winnipeg being the big winners in free agency. Generally, teams that do well in free agency make one or two really, really smart moves that help change their team rather than just going out and trying to build a team in free agency.
You are now listening to The Waggle, the official podcast of the Canadian Football League.
Welcome, 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 fans, to this podcast, The Waggle Podcast, brought to you by us here at CFL.ca and by our friends at Sport Clips. That's right, they're known for Sport Clips MVP haircut experience, massaging shampoos, hot steam towels, sports on TV like hockey, baseball, basketball, but most importantly, football. Oh, and that's right, the legendary haircuts. You can book your appointment online at sportclips.ca. That is sportclips.ca. And we have an off-season edition of The Waggle. Yes, it's the off-season already. Davis Sanchez is getting a well-deserved bye week as he had a great season for us. We're letting him rest. And we're bringing in the off-season insider, Dave Naylor, to break down all of the coaching moves and maybe some quarterbacks moving. Coming up next on The Waggle, Dave Naylor. And joining us now is TSN CFL insider Dave Naylor. And so, Dave, for many people, this is the off season, but for you, you're still in season. This is the busy season. And one of the big names that has already moved is Rick Campbell, who is now in BC. Why is that a fit? Because for many, it was, you know, one of the worst kept secrets of the very short off season.
Yeah, I think there was a sense that, you know, as soon as Rick Campbell's resignation and Devon Claybrook's firing happened about 72 hours apart, that they were destined for one another. And I think a couple of reasons. One is Rick Campbell is, you know, a successful head coach. You know, he'd been in, he won a Grey Cup. He got to two others. I mean, it was a good run for him as a first run as a head coach. The other thing, I think you look at what was the big complaint in BC was the lack of experience on the coaching staff, whether it was Devon Claybrooks or some of his assistants, guys in some cases who were, you know, in pads and helmets only a few months earlier than they were coaching. And so, you know, that I think was really what was ultimately Claybrooks, I think, biggest criticism. So you look at Ed Hervey, you know, all the coaches he'd hired before, Jason Moss, Chris Jones, Devon Claybrooks, he'd always gone to first-time head coaches. And this is the first time he's gone to a guy who has experience, 6 years of experience. So I think when you look at all that, and it's just, I think, a common sense, you know, head choice. And you look at a coach that has Rick's record, and I don't think people look at, I'm not sure that Rick handled the Ottawa situation as well as he could. I mean, I'm just speaking to, you know, his, whether it was his body language or his messaging after games, he seemed to really kind of get caught in the downturn of that team. But you also can't ignore the 6 years of success he had. And I think it makes it, you know, it's a good sense hire.
And so with Rick now in BC, as we do the coaching musical chairs, the next question is, what happens to Jason Moss? Does he go to BC and become an offensive coordinator? Many thought maybe Jason Moss would get back together with his former quarterback and former GM, and maybe Rick would make a return to Edmonton, where his father coached. Where do you think Jason Moss eventually lands?
I think there's a good chance that he ends up in BC. And sometimes, you know, the word on the street is right, and sometimes the word on the street is wrong. And, like, there was a pretty strong buzz going around the CFL not long after Devon Claybrooks got fired that Rick Campbell would end up in B.C. and Jason Moss would end up as the offensive coordinator if, of course, he got fired in Edmonton. At that point, Edmonton hadn't even lost. But, you know, Moss is going to have, I think, at the very least, his choice. I think offensive coordinator is a skill that's very much in short supply right now in the Canadian Football League. So I believe Ottawa has considered interviewing him as head coach. I don't know whether they've committed to that or not, but I know they were, the sense is they were mulling that over when he got fired in Edmonton. So, you know, obviously if Ottawa goes down that road and wants to hire him as their head coach, that would be, I'm sure, preferable to him. But I'm not sure Ottawa's committed to even giving him that opportunity or interviewing him for that opportunity. So otherwise, I think it does make sense. I mean, and you put it all together, as you say, so often to try to read the tea leaves in football, you just look at who's worked together successfully before. Well, Mike Riley was pretty successful when he played for Jason Moss. Jason Moss was hired by Ed Hervey in Edmonton. You know, you put all those things together and it does start to add up. And again, I'll go back to what I said at the start of the interview. It was one of the major criticisms of the BC team was, you know, lack of experience on the coaching staff. Well, if you made Jason Moss your offensive coordinator, you know, having a guy who's done that job, having a guy who served as a head coach, you know, that would certainly address that as well.
So much of this is supply and demand, and where there is a scarcity, and certainly, you know, someone is going to stand up and want the Ottawa job, but is it more difficult to get someone excited to take that job, given the previous coach put his hand up and said, I no longer want to be here?
I don't even know about that, because I think part of why people look at maybe, and again, I don't want to say Rick Campbell knew he was going to BC before he resigned, but I think he knew there would be another opportunity for him and there were places that were going to open up. And I think he may have thought he had a good shot at BC if that happened. So it wasn't like Rick Campbell resigned without any options. And it was just so terrible to be there that he wanted to get out of there. I think he knew he would have options. I think but again, I think anytime somebody walks away and says, I can't work with the general manager anymore, that is going to give somebody pause and want to investigate that situation. That was definitely a one-sided thing. I mean, you talk to Marcel Desjardins about that situation. He'd say, I had no trouble working with Rick Campbell. Rick Campbell had trouble, said I couldn't work with Marcel Desjardins. So, you know, it was definitely coming more from Rick's side of things. But the other thing, I think that the bigger thing for the Ottawa job is if I was taking that job, here's the first thing I want to know. What's our plan at quarterback? Because it doesn't appear they have a quarterback on the roster right now who's, you know, a serviceable starter in the CFL. And as we know, many great coaches have looked great when they've had great quarterbacks, and they've looked horrible when they haven't. Rick Campbell being the latest example of those in Ottawa when he went from, you know, Trevor Harris to Dominic Davis. So I think that's the hard thing. And I don't know how you promise that. Like, just for example, if Ottawa wanted to go after Nick Arbuckle, for say, right? Okay, so you're hiring a coach and you say, here's our plan. We're going to go after Nick Arbuckle hard at free agency. Well, what if the Toronto Argonauts are doing that as well? You know, it's really hard to, unless you're going to trade for somebody's rights. And, you know, we've seen that happen when there's been a free agent quarterback who's coming up to his expiration of his contract in February. Somebody says, okay, I don't want to get into bidding war. I'm going to make a preemptive move and try to sign this guy. Right? Ed Hervey did that trading for Mike Riley's rights when he was with BC as a backup and signed him in Edmonton. And it worked out very well. Jim Popp did that with James Franklin's rights from Edmonton, and it didn't work out so well. So, you know, that would be the one way of Ottawa. You might be able to make a trade for Arbuckle's rights and try to sign him before you get a coach, or say, this is our plan. But that to me would be the big question. If I'm the coach there, what's our plan at quarterback? Who am I coaching? Because right now we've got a void at that spot. And I can't really evaluate this job until I know what our plan is.
See, if I was the ownership group in Ottawa and Marcel Desjardins, my plan would have been, well, I'm going to go and I'm going to get Tommy Condell, and I'm going to hope that he's going to help me get Jeremiah Masoli whenever he's healthy. But Tommy Condell said, I'm fine exactly where I am. Did that surprise you?
A little bit. I think the problem with the Masoli theory that you have right there, which is a good one, is just, you know, do you know if he's going to be healthy or not, right? If you go and get Jeremiah Masoli on February the 13th when free agency starts, is he ready for training camp? Is he ready for week one of the regular season? And if he's not, when is he ready? And if you're a team like Ottawa or Toronto that might be interested in him, if he's not ready for till week six, is that too late? You know, that's the challenge there. I was a little bit surprised. I think sometimes, and we've seen coaches do this before, I think one of the things we're learning watching the, you know, Devon Claybrook situation of a one and done and others is that you don't necessarily get a long rope when you're a head coach, especially if you're a first-time head coach. And if you do get fired, I don't know, you tell me, is Devon Claybrook going to get another opportunity to be a head coach in the CFL? Maybe, but maybe not. And I think we've seen, you know, Paul LaPolice the last few years, I think, has, you know, turned away from some situations where he looked at it and thought, you know what? I'm in a pretty good situation in Winnipeg right now. We got a good team. I like our quarterback. I'd rather stay here and be successful and wait for the right opportunity than to jump into a head coaching job that I think that might not be right for me, or that I don't think we're set up for success. And I'll just use Toronto last year as an example. Paul interviewed with Toronto and basically told them, I don't think so. You know, that he just felt with the the composition of their staff and the people they were going to have to hold over, that he wasn't the right guy for that situation. So, you know, Mike Benavides did that years ago in Toronto, where he was, I don't know if he was offered the head coaching job, but he certainly interviewed for it and said, you know what, I'm going to stay and coach under Wally Buono a little longer because I think my opportunity will come and I want to wait for the right one. And I don't know if there was a unfinished business aspect of what Tommy Condell experienced last year with them, because of them losing the Grey Cups badly, but it didn't totally surprise me, no.
We're talking about all these coaching situations, and we haven't really addressed the one in Edmonton, that vacancy, which to me, if I was evaluating the three, Ottawa, BC, and Edmonton, Edmonton's the team closest to winning right now, and you have the quarterback taken care of. Who are potential names that you think would be a good fit in Edmonton?
Well, you're right about that, because I mean, this is a team that made the playoffs, right? That won a playoff game, and they fired their coach saying that they felt the team underachieved. So obviously, the general manager feels like this is a team that should be competitive for a Grey Cup based on, you know, their roster, and that's why he made the change. I think Paul Laplace is going to get a lot of attention there. And again, you know, if you look at the situation that he turned down in Toronto a year ago, and I don't believe he was offered the job in Toronto, but he certainly interviewed and then told them that he wasn't going to go any further. You know, this is certainly a more appealing situation. This is an advertisement for why you wait for the right situation as opposed to jumping at the first person that offers you a head coaching job. And I think Jamie Elizondo would have got some attention there. Of course, he's in the XFL with Tampa Bay. I think there was some mutual interest there for him. I think he'd like to be a head coach in the CFL, but he's committed to the XFL, and that situation, you know, is kind of sitting right there. So I expect that Laplace would get a lot of consideration there. And again, just as an offensive guy, you know, with Trevor Harris and a lot of the different things they have on that team, I think he would be a good fit there. And I would not be surprised at all if he landed there.
We haven't seen a change to this point. In Toronto with Corey Chamberlain, with a new general manager, it would be easy to make sweeping changes. Why do you think that is?
I think there's a couple of reasons. I think one is, I think that there's an economic component to it. I mean, you know, we're seeing these coaches getting fired, and you've got to amortize the rest of their contracts, what's committed to them over the next 5 years. I believe Corey's deal was a 3-year deal, the third year being a club option. But the second year is guaranteed. So if you're going to fire him, you know, that's going to cost you some money. I think there is a good relationship between Bill Manning, the president, and Pinball and Corey. I think they're going to make some significant changes to the staff. I think if there was somebody they knew they wanted, they looked at it and said, that's the guy we want. For instance, if Mike O'Shea was going to part ways with the Winnipeg Blue Bombers, I think the Toronto Argonauts would have made a move there and said, okay, Here's a guy who's had a solid record as a head coach. He's a former Argo. He's a guy who spent a lot of his life in Southern Ontario. And we think that, you know, we could repatriate him and make him, you know, our leader going forward. I think that could have happened, absolutely. But with all indications are that O'Shea's going back to Winnipeg, the Argos looked at it and said, is there really somebody that we think we have to have, or that we think is the right guy for this team that's going to take us? And I don't think they thought there was. I mean, there may have been people they were interested in, but there wasn't that one shining light that they said, that's the guy we want. The other thing I think is, anytime you're going to bring back a coach who's kind of on a short rope, and I think we have to assume after a 4-win season that Corey Chamberlain's going to begin next season as on a short rope, you better know who your next coach is going to be if things go off the rails. And I'm not somebody who really believes in firing coaches in midseason. I think in football, most of the times it doesn't work. It's not like hockey where you can bring a new voice behind the bench and all of a sudden the team wins 4 in a row. I mean, with football, with schemes and personnel, it's almost impossible to bring somebody from outside of the organization, and then promoting from within becomes your option. Look, I will not be surprised if the Argos do get off to a bad start next year, that their next head coach is the general manager, right? I mean, Pinball Clemens has done it before. He's replaced coaches in midseason before. I think that's his natural affinity. I would not be shocked at all. So I think the Argos are going to give Corey another shot. And if it doesn't work out, I would expect, I would say expect, just put me in the category of least surprised person if Pinball Clemens ends up replacing Corey Chamberlain because they got off to a lousy start.
That's fascinating. And because to be a head coach, you have to be there. You have to be present. And although Pinball was literally, as a head coach, the general manager of the coordinators who were coaches on their respective sides. You still have to be present and in the office every day. And that's a big, drastic change from being a GM where you can have a 5,000-foot view and kind of come in and leave as you please, and putting in coaches' hours where it's, 24/7 occupation. Is that something, given everything else that is going on in his life, that he could literally do efficiently?
Well, Mike Clemens is going to make some choices, because the way he's lived the last 10 years away from the CFL isn't going to be necessarily compatible with what he's got to do with the Argonauts now, whether he's general manager or coach. But look, every general manager does the job differently, right? Some guys are in the office every day. Some guys are on the road every day. Some guys are at practice every day. I expect that Mike Clemens, as a general manager, is probably going to be around the players a lot. I mean, that's just his nature, right? Mike is a communicator. He is a motivator. He's an inspirational type of person. And I think if he's not around your players, you're probably not taking, whether it's coaches or general manager, you're probably not taking best advantage of his skill set. And that's kind of where I see, his role here with the Argonauts, is that, again, as general manager, not coach, I expect to be a guy that you would see at practice a lot, kind of having that communication, wanting to, shall we say, contribute to the culture of the football team. Because that's what I think Mike probably does as well as anybody. If he did have to go, again, I don't want to anticipate that Corey Chamberlain isn't going to be successful next year and isn't going to finish the season, but I would be surprised if Mike was a guy who was never around the team as general manager. And if you're going to make a return to the CFL after 10 years, is it easier as a coach or as a GM? I think it's easier as a coach. I mean, the biggest challenge for Mike Clemens as GM is going to be, A, he's never done the job, and B, most guys who become general managers in the CFL are kind of neck deep in it when they become GMs. I mean, you just look at the guys that Montreal is talking about as candidates for their general manager job right now that we believe are on their short list. They're all guys that are in scouting and player personnel, and have been deep in it for a decade. Not somebody who's been away for a decade. So that's Mike Clemens' biggest challenge. And as much as it may be a challenge in general, if he were to come back to coaching, if he was to do so, I think the general manager's role is more of a challenge, just because it's so much about, being up on current players, not only in the CFL, but in the youth sports level and the NCAA. And I don't think that's what his focus has been the last 10 years. So he's got a lot of catching up to do. He's going to rely on John Murphy, their player personnel director, a lot. But compared to taking on the GM job being away, I don't think coaching would be that much of a stretch for him.
How much of these decisions now, and I'll use Toronto as the example because we're talking about them now, are fiscal, have to do with a football ops tax and what teams can afford to do with their football personnel? Look at an organization like MLSC, they're used to just throwing money at problems. And I don't say that disparagingly. If you look at when they've had an issue, whether it's the Leafs or the Raptors or TFC, their answer was to invest more capital. In that thinking, they could just have written a blank check and say, Michael Shea, name your price and name your staff. And now in the current scenario of the CFL, they can't do that. How much of these decisions in terms of who the coach and who his staff is going to be has to do with keeping a cap on the football ops costs?
Well, I think it does. It's not dissimilar to what, say, MLSE used to do with the hockey team, right? Like, if you go back in the early 2000s before the introduction of the salary cap, the NHL, the Leafs could just stay competitive by just blowing their brains out financially every year. And you're talking about, an organization that, pays Kyle Lowry a third of $1 million every night to play basketball for 48 minutes. That's when you actually do the economy of scale between what they're spending on CFL players and what they're playing on paying NBA players. And I know the revenue streams certainly for the NBA, are vastly different and justify those kind of salaries. But yeah, they would have at their disposal. I mean, I often joke that they heat the building by burning cash in the basement of the ACC. They've got so much sitting around. But it becomes, in a weird way, MLSE is not only do they not have an advantage when it comes to these kind of decisions for coaching and not being able to, have to be fiscally responsible, but they've got a disadvantage, as Vancouver would, because of the cost of living. I mean, the coaches' cap in the CFL is standardized across the league. So whether you're putting together a staff in Regina or Winnipeg, And the economics of that are far more advantageous to the Rough Riders and the Blue Bombers than they are to the BC Lions or the Toronto Argonauts. And I think, you know, when you look at, I mentioned the part of the reason I think they didn't want to fire Corey Chamberlain was because they'd have to amortize his salary and take that off their cap over the five-year period. When you're already dealing with a cap that you're in a disadvantaged situation with because of the economics and the cost of living in Toronto, I do think those things come into it.
Fascinating. Let's transition from the guys who are going to lead the teams on the sidelines to the guys who are going to lead the teams on the field and the quarterbacks. And I find this quarterback class in terms of free agency certainly not as touted as the one that we saw last year, which was unprecedented, but just as fascinating. Masoli, we talked about him briefly earlier in the podcast. Let's say, just for argument's sake, he's back in August sometime. And, you know, the ACL is not the worst injury to return from. I would make the argument that to win in this league, you need to have the quarterback situation taken care of. And even if he is not the answer for all 18 games this year, that decision in free agency is a decision for the next 2 or 3 years. And so he would be on the top of my board regardless of what time he was ready to be the starter. Is that thinking flawed?
Well, I think you do live in a sport where everybody thinks in the now. And in the CFL, I think people think in the now more than they do in some other leagues, and for a couple of reasons. One is, you know, with 6 out of 9 teams making the playoffs, there's, I think, an expectation among every team that you should be in the playoffs. And if you don't, you know, that somebody's got to answer for it. And the other thing is, this is still a gate-driven league. You know, if you looked in the NFL, in a situation like, say, Cincinnati and Marvin Lewis, I mean, he was there for so many years. They never had success in the playoffs, and they kept bringing him back. Well, why could they do that? Well, because they have full stadiums, right? And I think in a league where you're trying to sell tickets and you're very aware of what the customer thinks, I think fans and the sort of prevailing opinion of fans can get guys fired, right? So there's more of an urgency to win now in the CFL and to toss away a year or put a year at risk because you may not have. Now, look, I should say Jeremiah Mazzoli, I talked to him at Grey Cup. He thinks he'll be ready for the start of training camp. You know, other people will say, not specific to him, will just say, that's a 10 to 12 month injury. And if you do the 12 months, that comes out at July 27th, was when he went down. So, you know, and the other part of this is the pitch that Hamilton's going to make to him. I know the Ticats want him back. If I was the Ticats, this is the pitch I would make to him. You don't know when you're going to be back 100%. Your value in free agency as a guy coming off an ACL is going to be much lower than it is if you come back with us, play for a year, and go to free agency next year. Sign a one-year deal. We'll figure out the flight time between you and Dane Evans. We believe this is a two-quarterback league, and you know, we think it's best in your long-term interest to come back and spend another year with the Ticats. We think it's best in our short-term interest to have you come back for another year with the Ticats. That's the pitch they will make. But I think that, you know, maybe you go in a situation where a team says, okay, we can't count on him necessarily until 5 or 6 weeks of the season, but we got a guy that we think can get us to 500. You know, that basically, if you're going to sign Jeremiah Mazzoli, you're going to have some confidence in your number two that he can get you through the first third of the season because you just don't know. But I think if you pair that with somebody you believe in, with your logic of this is our guy for the next 3 to 4 years, and we got to overlook that first 6 weeks of the season, I think you can make that work. You just better have a plan for that first 6 weeks of the season. Because as much as people love to say, well, you know, in the CFL, nothing matters until after Labor Day. Really? Look at the standings on Labor Day and look at the teams that missed the playoffs. You know, tell the BC Lions and the Toronto Argonauts that nothing matters till after Labor Day.
Interesting pitch from Hamilton. And I totally get why they would want some security at the position, given the injuries we saw at the position to everyone this past season. I just wonder if I'm Jeremiah Masoli and I'm 31 and I know that the economics in terms of what Dane Evans is making moving forward and the difference between the age on my passport and his says that long term it would make sense for them to go in his direction. And I know that Ottawa and Toronto both are going to need a quarterback because they don't seem to have one in-house. I just wonder if Hamilton will be able to get to a number that would make that interesting for Masoli and make him not want to go to another market?
Well, the interesting thing is, and you don't see this very often, but because Dane Evans is signed for next season and the year after, I believe his base salary is about $100,000. Now, he's got playtime on top of that. But Hamilton's in the unique situation where they could actually afford to pay Jeremiah Mazzoli more than their starting quarterback. Now, normally the hierarchy is you pay your starter most and you pay your backup less, or you pay them both the same and you make the playtime money the difference, so the guy who plays makes the money. But because they have Dane Evans on this ridiculously friendly contract, they could have him, they could pay Jeremiah Mazzoli, you know, a significant amount to back up. I think the other question here is, how committed are the Ticats to Dane Evans as their starter for all 18 weeks? And is Jeremiah Mazzoli want to go to a place where they say, look, Dane Evans played really well with us. He's 25 years old. We see him as our future. He got us to a Grey Cup. You know, we plan that he's going to be our starter, and we expect that we'll need you somewhere along the way. Well, Dane Evans didn't get hurt at all this year during the season. He's a young guy, you know, seems to avoid hits pretty well. If you're Jeremiah Mazzoli, are you really willing to go back there and stand on the bench for potentially all season? And that's the part I think would be the hard thing for him, you know, that he could end up in a situation where he's in free agency in 2021, but hasn't really played football in a year and a half. So that's unlikely, but it's a possible scenario. So if I was Jeremiah Mazzoli, I'd say, A, what are you willing to pay me if I'm coming back to the Ticats for a year? And B, what role do you see me having? How much do you expect me to play? Or am I going in exclusively as the backup to Dane Evans? So it's one of the more fascinating situations we've had in a long time, because you have a guy who was playing at an MOP caliber really last season and this most recent season, I'm saying 2018 and 2019, who's right in his prime, who seems to have been displaced by a younger player who was exceptional in just his second year in the league and first year starting. And you've got a need for quarterbacks in at least two cities right within Ontario. So there's a lot of dynamics to try to weigh and figure out how this one will go. But ultimately, you know, Jeremiah Mazzoli is the one who holds the cards.
Yeah, it's this business, as you know, is about relationships. And I did hear the scenario of, well, they could, because Dane Evans' deal is so team-friendly, they could pay Mazzoli and bring him back. The issue would be Dane Evans' agent would be saying, excuse me, we have a starter here. You just paid backup, so you can't tell me that there is no money to readdress the starter's deal and get him commensurate with the other starters in the league. So that'll be interesting to see how that plays out in Hamilton. The other quarterback scenario that I find extremely fascinating is, what do you do in Winnipeg, where you have three quarterbacks who've all had some, at times, bits of success in the city. They all have at times struggled to stay healthy. You're coming off winning a Grey Cup, and you can't bring them all back. What do you do if you're Kyle Walters?
Well, I would think that you probably go back to the plan you had at the start of the year. Look, Pat Nichols was playing the best football of his life. His record as a starting quarterback with the Bombers is among the greatest in franchise history. He's right in his prime. He's invested in the community. He doesn't have a great history of staying healthy. He doesn't have a great history or a horrible history of being injured. You know, it's been a bit of both. But I think the Bombers could have and would have won the Grey Cup with him. I mean, not to sell Zach Collaros short here, but Zach Collaros did not come in and light up the league with his passing arm to help the Winnipeg Blue Bombers win the Grey Cup. The Bombers were a run-first team when Matt Nichols was their quarterback. They were a run-first team when Chris Streveler was their quarterback, and they were a run-first team when Zach Collaros was their quarterback. The Bombers won the Grey Cup with running the football, fantastic defense. I mean, they never gave up more than two touchdowns in any playoff game, you know, against Calgary, Saskatchewan, and Hamilton, which is remarkable, and not turning the ball over. That's how they won it. Not with a guy coming in for throwing for 430 yards a week. So I don't think Zach Collaros was, while he was important to what they did, I don't think it's a situation where you look at it and say, wow, you know, they could have never won it with another quarterback. Well, I think they could have. So, and again, I'm not trying to run Zach Collaros down. What he did in going 4-0 after not playing football, you know, for essentially a year is remarkable. But they were still not a sort of quarterback-driven offense. They were still a run-driven offense. So I think you look at Winnipeg and say, you know, Matt Nichols is still in his prime. We've had more success with him in the regular season than with almost any quarterback in franchise history. I could see bringing back him and Streveler. And you know, if you're Strebler, I think you got to recognize you're not yet ready to be a starting quarterback in the league. I think that was proven by, you know, his play this year. But you have tremendous assets in him, you know, things that no other quarterback can do. And if you go back to Winnipeg, you know you're not just going to be holding a clipboard week in, week out, that they're going to integrate you into the game plan because that's what they do. And that's what you need. You know, like it's most guys aren't ready to be starters in this league. So they've been in the league playing, practicing, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. Strebler's just at the end of year number two, and he's played more than a lot. But I think it makes sense for Matt Nichols. I think it makes sense for Chris Strebler. And I think it makes sense for the Winnipeg Blue Bombers for them to go that direction. And the other thing, the elephant in the room on Zach Collaros that you can't ignore is every GM in the league, when they look at Zach Collaros, is still worried that one hit and all of a sudden you've lost him. That is his history over the last two seasons. Just, and I'm not giving you my opinion, I'm just telling you what GMs think. They still are cautious about that. So I don't think Winnipeg would be prepared to go that direction. That's just my instinct. And I think Zach Collaros would make a lot of sense in Toronto, especially if you paired him maybe with a McLeod Bethel Thompson. So you've got two guys and you're going to let them kind of compete. He just bought a house just north of Toronto. He's recently married. I mean, he was kind of settled in. I think he was very happy about the trade to Toronto when it happened because it worked sort of for his life. And the Argonauts even said when they traded him, hey, you know, we'd love to have you back. We'll be really interested in watching and see how well you do in Winnipeg because, you know, we still have a quarterback need and we think you might be a fit here. So it is a very interesting and unique situation in Winnipeg with them using, I mean, how many times you see a team win a Grey Cup where they've had three different starting quarterbacks over the course of the season? I mean, not for 1 week at a time, for significant stretches. And then you throw in that all three of them are being free agents. Not one I can remember seeing one, but I will be surprised if Collaros is a Blue Bomber next year.
Zach is an interesting one because in his mind, given the way his season just ended, he sees himself as a starter. But how much money can you attribute to a player, as you mentioned, who could be one hit away? Given that he is a veteran and he has some years accrued in the league, how creative can you get with his contract so that you have some protection and that there's bonuses based on games played, games started, so on and so forth? But also, you know, obviously the minimum salary has to be commensurate with someone who's been in the league for a little bit.
Well, we did some phoning around on this exact topic, you know, after he won that first game with Winnipeg, just saying, wow, you know, what is Zach Collaros' market value in the league? What would people pay him as a quarterback? And again, this is, he went on and won three playoff games in the Grey Cup after I had those conversations. So I just want to make that clear. But I think what I heard at that time is still largely true, although it may have been, you know, evolved a little bit here. And the idea was that you would be able to pay him, you know, a hard money number, which is, let's say, you know, $200,000 to $250,000 a year. Maybe before he went on the playoff run, it was more like $150,000. But you're basically saying, here's the money that we're going to guarantee you this year. You know, we know that whether you're healthy or whether you're hurt or whatever, you know, then we'll pay you $200,000 a year. And we're going to pay you $10,000 a start on top of that. So if you believe you can stay healthy, which is, you know, if you're continuing your career, it's because you believe you can stay healthy, then, and you want to bet on yourself, well, you can make $380,000 playing for us next year if you start for all 18 games. You know, we'll pay you 200 base, and so it's really not that complicated to work out something like that. It's really just negotiating on, okay, what's the hard, what they call hard money. What's the hard money number? Is it 175? Is it 200? Is it 250? That's really what you have to establish. And I think I would be surprised if Collaros or his representative, Dan Burtley, you know, aren't prepared for the fact that that's what the market is going to be. It's just a matter of what that number is and how much it might have evolved based on the four games that he played and won for the Blue Bombers.
And lastly, what are your takeaways from the 2019 season that you kind of reflect on and maybe might be instructive on how 2020 is going to go? I'll give you mine. In the offseason last year, we talked about all the skill position players that were moving and how they could make an impact, and obviously the three, you know, big-name quarterbacks. And at the end of the year, the two teams left playing, really they got there based off of building at the line of scrimmage and building defensively their front seven, and really the spine of their team. And those, you know, Darrell Walker, the great receiver, and the great quarterbacks that all moved, none of them were playing in the Grey Cup. So as much as the game has become a passing game on both sides of the border, It's still, at least this year anyways, one in the trenches. What for you is the thing that really stuck out to you about 2019?
Well, you make a great point, because I believe the Winnipeg Blue Bombers were last in the league in passing, right? How often do you say the Grey Cup champion, and not a fluky Grey Cup champion, right? A team that for a lot of the year was considered the best team in the league. And when Matt Nichols was healthy, they were last in the league in passing then too. Not passing efficiency, but passing yards, just in terms of pure volume. So, yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see, because often we'd say in sports, you know, teams imitate. But I think to your point, quarterbacks are important, no question. You need, but having a great quarterback doesn't guarantee you win, right? See the BC Lions in 2019. That's the lesson. I think if we took quarterbacks out of the equation and said, okay, every quarterback in the league is equal at the start of the year, who are the two best teams in the league? I think we might have said Hamilton and Winnipeg, right? And the fact that they both got, you know, in Hamilton's case, very good quarterback play, and in Winnipeg's case, you know, decent quarterback play. I think one of the things, yeah, that is one of the lessons, that A, the league isn't all about passing, because we saw the Blue Bombers win running the football, and running the football with three different quarterbacks. You're more likely to win a Grey Cup with a good football team and average quarterback play than you are with a great quarterback and a sub-average team. And I'll just use the Blue Bombers and the BC Lions as comparatives, right? I don't think anybody thinks that, you know, Mike Riley's a lousy quarterback, and yet, you know, they missed the playoffs by a wide margin. And I don't know that anybody would put Matt Nichols or even Zach Caleros at this stage of his career and say that they're better than Mike Riley, and yet, you know, they won the Grey Cup as a dominant team. So I think it's, yeah, I think it's – and the other lesson I would say is, and I've said this one before, is the Grey Cup is not won in February. You know, like, I don't remember Hamilton or Winnipeg being the big winners in free agency back in February. Generally, teams that do well in free agency make one or two really, really smart moves that help change their team, rather than just going out and trying to build a team in free agency. And you look at Winnipeg, you know, they did that with Willie Jefferson, right? He was a guy that they went after in free agency, and he really gave them a presence because they hadn't had. So, yeah, I think, as you say, it's still a run league. It's not all about quarterback play, and free agency, you know, isn't the end-all be-all, would be three of the takeaways I would take from 2019.
And as we move into 2020, what's the biggest question that hovers around the league that has you kind of thinking and contemplating about it that needs to really be addressed?
Well, I think there are a few. I don't know if there's one, but I'll just throw – I think really the interesting thing was, for one of the things going into this year, is what's the impact of the next wave of global players going to be? I think we were all underwhelmed for the most part, you know, Theodric Hansen aside in Winnipeg. But the quality of the global players they brought into the league this year was, you know, to put it bluntly, not good enough. They didn't make enough of an impact. This is Randy Ambrosi's vision to have players from around the world, you know, participating in the CFL. Well, the first thing, and I'll give the league credit for this, okay? They know that the players they bring into this league have to be better than the ones that played in this year, especially as you go from one player per team on the active roster now to two, and then three on practice roster. So every team's going to have five global players next year. You know, two on the active roster, three on the practice. That's 45 global. That's an entire team of players from outside of North America. All of a sudden, that sounds like a lot, you know. And look, they're running combines all across Europe. They're going to run another combine in Mexico. They're going to run a combine in Japan. So there is a significant investment in trying to make sure that they actually do uncover and recruit the best players from outside of North America, not just the guys that were available or were recommended to them, which is, I think, what happened this past offseason. So I'm kind of curious to see, you know, given that the depth of the league is going to go on this, is what are the impact of those global players going to be? And are we going to see guys? And I think people got a lot of excitement, you know, when Theodric Hansen made plays for Winnipeg. So this is a guy from Germany, you know, and then how he could be an impact player. I think we started to feel some of that buzz about that. So let's see if we can see, you know, what that creates next year. So that's one of the sort of league issues that, you know, that I'll be very curious about. And I guess the other is just seeing how many of the quarterbacks who got playtime this year through all the injuries are going to be able to continue that next year. I mean, whether it was Cody Fajardo, I mean, who had him? I always joke about this, that, you know, somebody said to me at the time that he took over as the starting quarterback, you know, well, we know he's not going to throw for 5,000 yards. And I said, I thought, well, would you go for 4,300 and lead in the league? I mean, it were just so many surprises, you know, in quarterback play this year. And how many of those guys, whether it was Dane Evans or Nick Arbuckle or Cody Fajardo, guys that were expected to spend the year on the bench and got their opportunities and really ran with it, are going to be able to sustain it into 2020?
Yeah, well, it made it a fun year to watch, a fun year to cover. The fact that we had guys coming out of the woodworks and playing good football at the most important position. And so I'm fascinated to see where some of them land in free agency and how teams fill out the rosters. Thank you so much for breaking it all down for us here on The Waggle, Dave.
My pleasure, Donovan. Thanks so much.
And thanks again to Dave Naylor of TSN, the Football Insider, for joining us on The Waggle and breaking down all the news that is really on the top of your minds and really my mind, as you heard, now that we are into the business season, if you will, the off season, as the in season has ended. But the CFL season never sleeps, so make sure. CFL.ca and follow us on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook for all of the off-season news we'll have you covered. And we'll have you covered right here on The Waggle. So make sure to join us next week and like, share, favorite, and subscribe. Take it easy.